Welcome to the Militant Grind Show, where we dive deep into the journeys of those who've mastered the art of being their best selves. Every episode is a testament to resilience, dedication, and the pursuit of excellence, embodying our tagline, the most honorables. Here you'll find inspiration, insights, and strategies to elevate your life in every aspect. For more empowering content and to join our community of achievers, visit us at militantgrind.com. Let's embark on this journey together because the grind never stops. Are you ready for a radical transformation? Join the ranks of the most honorables. Our proven methods forge resilience, sharpen strategic thinking, and unlock your true potential. We'll challenge you mentally, physically, and spiritually, preparing you to overcome any obstacle. Visit militantgrindacademy.com and begin your evolution. Greatness awaits. Forge your path, ignite your future. Most of all, join the movement.
Dan Goldfield, a dedicated mindfulness practitioner, overcame chronic pain and continued his music career through deepening his practice with guidance from a Buddhist monk and a personal development course. Notably, he helped his mother recover from a suicide attempt in 2017. His teachings, refined with input from his neuropsychologist partner, have earned high ratings on Insight Timer and aided many in overcoming personal challenges. Dan's successful course and coaching practice, in collaboration with business coach Dan Cole, aims to normalize well-being for over a billion people. Dan, how are you doing today, sir?
I'm doing great, Sherman. Good to be with you, my brother.
Good to be with you too, man. Glad that we're finally on, and I feel like this is a perfect time to talk about what we're going to talk about, because I've been doing some research on like pranic healing, Reiki, things of that sort, and then I feel like you might be in that space in some kind of way.
Not so much my wheelhouse, actually.
Oh yeah?
Anything that would be constituted as healing. Mm-hmm. So more on that meditation and mindfulness side, although I would say pranic healing, Reiki, we're close neighbors.
Oh, okay. Okay. So what would you say a mindfulness practitioner is exactly?
So I decided that mindfulness was going to be the solution for me to combat stress. That was the principal problem that I was dealing with. I'd been a musician for many, many years, started playing the drums at age 11. And I was just hunched over those things, banging them as hard and as fast as I could for 20 years. Approaching the age of 30, that was beginning to take its toll. I'd picked up some bad habits along the way, both physical and mental. And it turned out that that chronic pain that I was experiencing was actually a symptom of stress. I was holding myself in tension. I actually went to see a chiropractor first. Mm-hmm. And she said to me, there's nothing wrong with your spine, dude. There's no pathology here. There's nothing wrong. You're doing this to yourself. And that was a paradigm shift for me. I was like, I didn't know I could be doing this to myself. What do you mean? She said, look, you could come see me every fortnight for the rest of your life. I'll put you right. You'll go put yourself wrong again. I'll put you right again. She said, it'll be expensive. Or you can go and see someone who teaches Alexander technique, she said. Now, I don't know if you ever heard of Alexander technique, Sherman.
No, I haven't.
This is pretty niche. The Alexander technique teacher teaches people like me to stop putting themselves wrong.
Hmm.
So where I was constantly holding myself in tension, I picked up all these bad habits to the point that they were part of my identity, right? Just the way that I held myself as a human being.
Yeah.
It was all fucked up. Worst when I was at the kit. But also between shows, like I said, it's just part of my identity at that time. So I'm there in chronic pain. I go to see this guy giving these Alexander technique lessons, and I feel relief like I haven't felt for decades at that point. I'm like, what did you do? This is voodoo.
Trying to find something to write on really quick. I don't want to miss that, but the Alexander technique. And so do you break down how you would practice the Alexander technique?
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's a mental discipline, and this went really well with the mindfulness practice that I was doing. So I had a kind of 1-2 punch going for a good 5 years there. The Alexander technique taking care of how I was moving, how I was using my body, and then the mindfulness practice taking care of the mind and the emotions.
Mm-hmm.
So I really wanted to cover all bases. The best way for me to tell you how Alexander Technique works is to tell you about Alexander himself. He was an actor in Australia at the beginning of the 20th century, and he was losing his voice. He was reciting Shakespeare and he was losing his voice, and he exhausted all of his options for therapy and said to his doctor, "Could it be something I'm doing to myself?" And his doctor said, "You better fucking hope so, dude. Like, that's all you got." So this guy, Alexander, goes and sets up a bunch of mirrors in his study and starts to watch himself as he's reciting, bearing in mind, like, no cameras, right? He's not got his iPhone on the GorillaPod there. He's got to use these mirrors to watch himself. And over a number of years of long study, he eventually solved his problem. So he came back to the stage. He was able to then recite Shakespeare and do his work without losing his voice. Then other people started coming to him saying, "Can you tell me how to stop fucking my voice up?" And so he started working with other people. Then he found that he could apply his technique to any profession, not just actors. Now, what he had done during that time that he was studying himself was effectively he'd noticed certain ways that he was using himself that was causing the damage and learned to stop doing those things as a mental discipline. So that's the nutshell version.
Wow, I think I need to practice that for myself.
Good shit, man.
I'm sure everyone needs to in some type of capacity. I'm sure everyone can find that useful for sure.
He certainly thought so. His whole premise was, while we were evolving with our environment, it was all good. There was a lot of variety in the way that we were using our bodies, and so we didn't have to think too much about it. Now that we're all doing repetitive shit over and over and over again, we've got all these problems. And so he said, what we need to do then is bring more of a conscious control of ourselves to bear in our activities. And now we're really in the domain of, sounds like a mindfulness practice, right? So now I've got this very kind of comprehensive across the whole of myself. I'm covering all the bases. I've got this body practice. I've got a mind practice. I've got an emotional practice. And slowly I'm beginning to dissolve that stress that was causing me all of that pain. I'm also addressing emotional issues, childhood stuff. All of that is in the mix. And I'm suffering less and less. So then when my mother attempted suicide in 2017, I was like, well, this, I've got to share this stuff with my mom. This is the only way I really know how to help her out. So I'm going to help her out. That was when I delivered that to her and then started getting my teacher's blessing to go on and take on more students myself.
Wow. Wow. And so how was, like, you, did you go on a retreat with the monk or something like that?
Yeah, I went on a 10-day retreat in Thailand, spent a little time at his place as well out on Koh Phangan. Most of our work was remote. We were talking like you and I are talking right now. And the story of how he came to that is kind of interesting. So the teachings that he represents were kind of driven underground by the Thai government in the 20th century. And then when the internet happened, they started sending monks out of the monastery to teach online. That was where I actually found this teacher on Reddit.
Oh, wow. For really?
Really, man. Yeah.
Oh, snaps. That's crazy.
I know, right? I know. There's a small subreddit of real dedicated mindfulness practitioners called Stream Entry. It was really, really small back then. But it was kind of, it was a great community because people were just writing about their experience free of dogma, free of any kind of cultural baggage. Just, hey, I've been experimenting with this practice from Tibet. Oh, I've been experimenting with this one from Thailand. Here's what happened. Let's compare notes.
Oh, right? Wow.
Yeah, yeah. Pretty cool. So someone made a post saying, someone made a post saying, I've been chatting with this guy who lived as a Buddhist monk for 8 years. He's on Koh Phangan and he's teaching over Skype. He's taking more students. Does anyone want to chat with him? And I was like, oh, I'm keen, but like, I don't want to be reading Buddhist scripture and shit. He said, it's not like that. It's like talking to your granddad. Call this guy up. He's an American guy who found his way to Thailand via India and lived there for 8 years as a monk and then came out and, like I say, started teaching online where they were like, well, the politics is out of the picture now. How it was working was, obviously, mid kind of 20th century, Thailand was still a developing country. The government didn't want the public getting the real deep teachings because they were like, well, they're going to stop working in the factories kind of thing.
Oh, wow.
Right. So if they want to shave their head and run off into the forest with you, you can give them the real deep shit. But while they're out here as a member of the public, right, we need them just like going to the temple on the weekends, making their donation, lighting their incense and getting the fuck back to work.
Right.
Right. So again, when the internet happened, they were like, well, we don't have to play that game anymore.
Mm-hmm. Man,
so they were finally able to teach what they were given in the monasteries to regular people like you and me.
Wow. And so during those 10 days, I'm sure it was like no cell phones, no electricity, or was it?
There was no cell phones, no electricity, no books even. There was a very small selection of reading material, which was by my teacher's teacher. And they had dictionaries. That was it. And I was so bored at one point. I remember reading the front matter in the dictionaries, just trying to get a little entertainment. I read about the history of the English language, and I was like, this is amazing. I've never been so entertained, right? In that vortex of just having no occupation for the mind.
Yeah, yeah. Wow. This reminds me of like Doctor Strange, like, which is one of my favorite movies. Like, seriously, yeah. I'm gonna watch that movie over and over and over and over and over. And it's like, listen to your story, it's like, wow, he went to Carmitage. He found his way. Yeah. And then he became a mindful practitioner. It's like, man, but it's just like me hearing your story, it's like, what? People really do that then? Like, you went to Thailand, you went with a monk, you were there for 10 days. And the reason why I assumed that there was no electricity or cell, well, they did say it's Wi-Fi in the movie. But I kind of like figured that in real life it's not like that. But it's just like, wow, man, like if people can shut off the world for 10 days and end up changing their whole being, that is some pretty powerful stuff.
Yeah, people have profound experiences on those retreats. For me, that 10 days was in the midst of a dedicated practice that was already years long. So that 10 days wasn't actually that transformative for me. In fact, if I got one takeaway from that 10 days, it was that I don't actually need to ordain as a monk in order to figure this shit out. I'd been really seriously considering it prior to that experience. And then when I went there and saw the monastery and stayed in the retreat center, I was like, this is just another place. And this is my teacher had been telling me this, right? But I'm fantasizing about like, I'm going to be a monk. I'm going to get enlightened. I'm going to do all this shit. I saw it was just another place. And in fact, if anything, a lot of the monks are working harder than we work out here.
Mm.
Except it's like, just they're maintaining the monastery.
Mm-hmm.
But they're like cleaning toilets. They're mopping the floor. They're doing all of that, cooking a bunch of food for visitors and shit. So it's a lot of the existence in there is quite mundane. And that was shocking to me, right? Because I was thinking I was going to go and hang out with these guys who were like sitting full lotus 12 hours at a time, meditating. Well, they do meditate a lot, but they also do this very worldly, very mundane activity, which wouldn't be glamorous at all by our estimations.
So you basically just learned how to be at peace with yourself and how you are as a person, because I can't understand how a westernized person could go into that. Like, you know, like I'm like, because I feel like we're just built so different. And it's like going from how we are to that, it's kind of like I don't know, you probably can't, but I could just see the great resistance. And I actually had a talk with my wife yesterday, and we both went to historically Black colleges, right? And so our thoughts was like, okay, we're at a Black college, we're around Black people. But one experience that we both agreed on that we got from being in a college with people that look like us in the world, in a country where we're a minority, is that all of us are different. Like a Black man from Louisiana is totally different than a Black man from LA, New York, Florida. It's like everyone is different. And one thing that I've learned is just to be able to accept myself for who I am and be proud of that. And not try to like imitate anything else than who I am naturally. You know what I'm saying? So it's like, say, growing up, I always been fascinated with like having long hair. Maybe because the rap artists and stuff had it. But for some reason, something just was like, man, I just want one long hair one day. And now as an adult, I'm like, why don't you just do it? Like, why don't you do it? And now it's like, people are like, oh my God, I love your hair. I love how it looks. I'm like, yeah, because it fits me, because I just wanted this. You know what I'm saying? Like, something mm-hmm. in my DNA was like, you need to do this. Mm-hmm. Then I'm learning about Samson in the Bible and how his hair was his strength and things like that. And I was just thinking, like, you can get revelations to yourself without having to do too much. You know what I'm saying? Like, it's already within us. It's already mm-hmm. within you. You just try to, like, I had this revelation when I was meditating. It's like, why do you keep trying to look for something when you already know what to do? It's crazy. Because, and then I remember my neighbor growing, he was in and out of jail and stuff like that. And I'm not sure if he came inside my room or something. And he was like, why are you buying all these books when you already know everything? And I was like, what the hell are you talking about? But now I'm like, after 12, 14 years, I'm like, oh, I get what he's saying now. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It is all, if we're talking about truth, then it's true all the time for everyone.
Yeah.
Right. And we're going to all have our individual character on top mm-hmm. of that. Right. Mm-hmm. They say the conscience is the authentic voice of God, right? And when we learn to tune into that conscience, what we're hearing is what's most authentic for us.
Right.
That call to align with natural forces, wisdom, virtues, values
mm-hmm.
that we do all know, right? We know what good is. We know what bad is, right? Yeah. We know it feels good to be generous. We know it feels bad to be mean, right? Right. You've got kids, right? You probably, I don't know how old they are, but you've either taken or are taking them through that territory.
Mm-hmm.
You get to see them figuring that stuff out, right?
Right, right.
They think they feel good when they're mean to each other, but not really. That's coming from anger. They don't feel good as a baseline in a moment like that,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
So we get to guide them towards that natural condition of kindness, compassion, generosity. This is our natural state. These are the deepest teachings that I found in these Eastern philosophies, that our natural state is basically good.
Yeah.
And that anyone who... Go ahead.
Oh, no. Like, say you bringing up kids and I have four children and I can like see that. It's like people are really born how they are. Like all of my kids are totally different. And it's like, I can't really beat them into a submission of who they're not. Like one of my oldest daughters, she likes to play basketball and sports and things like that. And my youngest wants to paint her nails and wear dresses every day. Two totally different personalities. And I'm just like, if this is what y'all want to do, I'll point you in that direction. Here's a makeup kit. Here's a mirror. For you, here's a basketball. And I'm not going to say, don't play bad. That's not for girls and women shouldn't do this. And I'm like, look, man, I don't really care. If you feel in your heart this is what you want to do, I'm going to support it. As long as you're not doing any damage to yourself. But I feel like in our societies, we want to beat people into submission on what we think is best for them. And I feel like that's where like one of the main disconnects come in at.
Yeah. Yeah, it's damaging, man. I had a terrible time in school for that exact reason.
Mm-hmm.
They're trying to beat us all into shape. It blows my mind. Kids learn to walk and talk without our intervention. We might guide them a little bit, but we can't tell them how to do it.
Right.
Right. Mm-hmm. And then the kids hit five and suddenly we're like, line up, sit up, sit down, shut up. Now do it how we tell you. Right. Meanwhile, they're curious about this. They're curious about that. They want to explore over there. And that's all being suppressed now.
Mm-hmm.
Because we're saying, well, now you got to be interested in math. Now you got to be interested in science.
Yeah.
When maybe they're more interested in makeup, in basketball, right?
Right.
And of course, like the great enabler now for us to all follow our core passions is the technology around us.
Mm-hmm.
No one needs to study that small selection of subjects that's presented in school anymore because we can all make a living doing what the fuck we want.
Right. I told somebody that the other day and they just didn't get it. I was like, honestly, bro, like you don't really need to perfect anything, especially with AI. It's like all you could do is just write down your thoughts. Hey, write this up, send it to this person, and it'll make it perfect. You know what I'm saying? It's like, I don't have to perfect the English language anymore. Yeah. I have an artificial thing that could do that for me, and I could focus on this. But if you really think about it, right? When we think about a genius, who do we think about? The first person that comes to your mind.
Da Vinci, right?
Huh?
Da Vinci. It's the first person who came to my mind. Yeah.
Was centuries ago.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's known that people get smarter, what, every 10 years, human beings get smarter. So you're calling Da Vinci somebody that was alive centuries ago a genius. And me and you are talking through a screen right now, something that he probably couldn't even conceive.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? But one thing I do know about Da Vinci is that during his time, he didn't have all of these distractions. He didn't have to learn history, PE, physical education, all of these different things in order to survive. All he had to do was focus on his work, which was one thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like now we're just being bungled down by so many different things that we have to learn to survive. It's like, I can't even focus on my genius anymore.
Yeah. Yeah. We have to really deliberately curate our attention, curate all these feeds that we're on all fucking day, right? If we're not consciously removing anything that's not of value to us, anything that's not constructive, then once there's a crack, right, those algorithms will just fill it and fill it and fill it and fill it with distractions, exactly as you say, right? So I went to great lengths to simplify my life as far as possible, because I figured, look, I'm not going to write in my fucking bio that I want to normalize well-being for a billion people and then be doing all kinds of various shit. Like, if I actually want to achieve that in or shortly after my lifetime, like, I fully expect that to be a goal that I may never see come to fruition. Mm-hmm. But if I can set up a legacy throughout my lifetime, right? But even if I'm going to get that set up before I die, I need to be one track minded like Da Vinci.
Yeah, man, I thought I was simplifying my life, but it just took weeks for me to like really do it. Like, I had a point where I was like, I don't care about Instagram. I don't care about Facebook. I don't care about Twitter. Because it's just like, I just felt like I was overexerting myself for attention that wasn't leading into anything. And I feel like it was messing up my thought patterns and the way I even projected myself, because my brain is just so used to being distracted by all of these different things that I have to pay attention to.
Yeah.
And I was like, man, somebody sent me a message on Instagram. Somebody messaged me on Facebook. Somebody responded on Twitter, TikTok, Snapchat. Mm-hmm. Oh, somebody's calling me. Somebody sent me a message. And I'm like, that is way too much going on. Like, you have to simplify this.
Yeah.
For me. Yeah. Now, some people could do it. But for me, I'm like, I can't do it. It's too distracting. But then also what's on the social networks, just to pull and grab your attention, is very distracting too.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'm with you on that. I'm like, if I'm continuing a podcast, I have my business page up, cool. But it's like, I don't really want all of this access anymore. And then then I thought about this. I was like, okay, I'm gonna limit it to 1 hour a day. And then I was thinking about, I was like, 1 hour a day is a full work week. That's like 32 hours. What can I do with 32 hours a month instead of being on social media?
Put it in those terms.
Yeah. I mean, like, when you really think about it, like, I was like, okay, I'm paying $100 a month for this service, but it's $1,200 a year. Can I do anything with $1,200 at the end of the year besides use this? Do I really need it? No. You know what I mean? And then, like, I'm on that same time. I'm just basically letting you know I'm on that same time, because I started thinking about people that are like extremely successful and how they spend their time and what they spend their time on. And my ego was telling me, you could do it, man. You're the man. You could do all of these things. But then I was like, if you really look at the cycles, this isn't really going to happen.
And that's wisdom. That's wisdom, right? Being able to take that honest look and say, actually, this isn't serving me.
Right.
I got to cut it out, even though it feels good. It tickles all those brain centers, right?
Man. Yeah.
I can't remember what the figure was. Billions and billions and billions of dollars have been spent on those algorithms specifically for hooking in the human mind.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And if any of us think we're immune to that, we're fools.
Come on, man. Exactly.
Right.
Come on. Like, you could, like, I mean, I'm sure if I go on there now, I'm going to see a half naked woman.
Mm-hmm.
And my instincts are like, oh my God, look at that. Oh, it's like, come on, bro. Like, you're a human being. You think you're going to see a woman with her chest out or her butt sticking out and just be like, oh, okay. No, you know, like be real with yourself. No, you're not. Like, anybody is going to, if anybody that sees anything attractive is going to be, going to do something to you.
Yeah.
Therefore, just, you either have to eliminate it or not be in that space.
Yeah. Yeah. Precisely. We have to control the environment, right? Now, I remember thinking that if I did enough mindfulness practice, maybe I could get immune to that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Much later, I would realize, right? No, we never rip out the hardware.
Right.
Right? We're just learning to manage ourselves in the way that you did when you saw, no, this isn't serving me. I need to cut this out, right?
Yeah.
And if we get good enough at doing that, then maybe we can see it coming. Right. So we never even fall into the trap in the first place.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. That's exactly right. Cause it's like you said, like, we think we could defeat the hardware, but it's not possible to defeat the hardware. Like, if you put some, I'm exercising, if you put some ice cream and a cookie in my face, I'm probably, and I'm hungry, I'm probably going to eat it. Like, period.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And one thing that I have learned, cause I went to a Buddhist temple as well, and one thing that I've learned from being in that space is that you have to be honest about humanity and how humans function and how humans think. And I give them like great credit for that, because they're more like honest with it. Like, say my friend that's a Buddhist, he's well, ethnic wise he's Jewish, but he's also Buddhist as well. So say if I plan something and I say, oh man, I'm sorry, I forgot. He was like, don't worry about it. Things happen. It'll be okay. When the time is right, I'll be here. And I'm looking at him like, what? Because I'm thinking that he's going to react in a way like, oh man, you wasted my time or this is that. And he's just like, hey man, life happens. Everything's not going to be perfect. Yeah. And I'm like, what the hell? Like, every time, like every time he's just like, calm and at ease, but then he's looking at life from like a realistic point of view. Like, everything isn't for you. Some people are gonna flake, some things are gonna happen to throw you off course. Hey man, that's life. It is what it is.
Yeah. 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 And he's done that practice ahead of time to where when that unfavorable circumstance comes at him,
mm-hmm.
he's ready for it. Right.
Right. Right.
I can handle this. I don't need it to go my way in order to be okay.
Right.
Right. So maybe mm-hmm. he's spoken to you about one of the Buddha's deepest teachings on attachment, right? It's when we're attached, right?
To
things be in a certain way. That's where the dissatisfaction comes in. And that's where we feel bad. We lash out. We get emotional. We're reactive, etc. Where if that attachment isn't there in the first place, there's nothing to get upset about.
Yeah.
We cut it all off at the root.
A wise man told me that a long time ago. He was like, never get attached to anything material. You know, and maybe I should in a certain extent so I could wash my car. But but I'm like, it just made so much sense, because I was even talking to my wife earlier, and I was like, man, if someone comes to my house and there's something that I bought for me, I will freely give it to them. Just off of the fact that I know there's a store down the street and I could buy it. Like, if I need to re-up, I could get some more. Like, it's not that big of a deal. So say if I bought some ice cream and somebody comes to my house and they want ice cream, I'll give it to them. Why not?
Yeah.
You know, like, they're not going to stop making ice cream. I'm not going to, oh, I bought that for me. I'm gonna eat it tonight. I'll be like, have whatever you like.
Yeah.
Because it's coming from like an abundance type of mentality where it's like, there's enough for all of us. I'm not attached to this ice cream.
Yeah.
Or
yeah.
this store or whatever that I bought for myself.
Right. And there really is now more than ever enough for all of us, right? If we can't appreciate abundance in 2024, mm-hmm. living here in the first world, like, we might have as much as the human race is ever going to have.
Oh my God. Yeah, by far.
Right?
By far. I mean, like, man, it's so crazy because like, I was on DoorDash or Postmates and I was like, okay, I'm going to look at ordering a cake or something. And I was like, so you're telling me I could order a cake that's like in a different state and it will ship it to me? If I'm like, what? When did this, like, Amazon, you know what I'm saying? Like, I told somebody this, I was like, we live in a world where it's like, you do not have to leave your house to survive.
Yeah. Yeah. You really could stay in for a long fucking time.
Right. Heck yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Heck well, yeah. People are more and more, right? I don't know if you heard about a lot of young dudes in Japan now. There's a bit of an epidemic of this. Dudes just shutting themselves away, don't want to participate in society. And they can do that like never before, precisely because they can get everything they need delivered to their door.
Right.
Right. So there's a dark side to this availability.
Mm-hmm.
Right. It's enabling a kind of isolation that really isn't healthy at all. And indeed, the downstream of that is their birth rates are plummeting.
Oh, wee.
Yeah. Young people are not having sex in Japan. They are not having children in Japan. And that's going to be trouble. They've got infrastructure for a certain amount of population. And the people to keep that infrastructure running are not being made.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
I mean, scary. I can honestly see that now because it's like, I mean, this would be, are you in your late 30s at all?
Yeah, 37.
Okay, yeah, so we're about a year apart. I'm 38. So when we were growing up, people would have sex and recklessly, and kids will come into this world. Like, there was rarely a time where somebody was like, yeah, me and my girlfriend are planning to have a baby. But now we're in a world where it's like people could be extra safe. But then it's like if someone doesn't want kids, they literally don't have to have kids. Like, ever. Like, there was always a time, like, in our generation where it's like, oh, man, I heard you're having a baby. Damn, how do you feel about that? Oh, man. But it just happened. Like, I know I wasn't planned, and my kids definitely were not planned. And then it's like, they're not even getting the chance to really interact because of porn, because of sex toys, because of all of these different things. Because the brain is very powerful. If I could see somebody having sex and then act as if it's me inside the act, I could hear them, I could see it all, you know what I mean? Even though you really don't look at all that while you're having sex, but it's like you're seeing all of that, any kind of pleasure you want, woman, man, whatever. What is that doing to your brain? That's like, why would I go out, spend money, do this and do that when I could just go on Pornhub and, you know, do my thing?
It's right there. Whatever you want.
Yeah.
An endless stream. You know, for me, this was like as a 12-year-old boy.
Oh, no, there's no way I could be alive.
That stuff just streamed into my bedroom as a youngster, right? Young kids, curious. I got a computer in my bedroom. Of course I'm going to click, right?
Yeah.
No one even knew of the dangers of this stuff back then, right? Wasn't even a conversation. Right. And so much of the internet is like this, right? We can say it's the same with less stimulating forms of entertainment, although some of the video games are up there, of course. These are, I think the term is hyper stimuli, right? Stimulus that the brain didn't evolve to handle, right? I heard one dude talking about how for our ancestors, they may have seen 1 to 3 naked bodies in their lifetime. And you think of the speed at which pornography can deliver naked bodies to the human brain.
Right.
Like you say, man, it's got to be doing something. Like, come on.
It's desensitizing you to... I had a podcast with a guy, and we were talking about porn addiction. And he said that like a lot of men who are in their late 20s are virgins still. And then they don't even understand that like human bodies have a smell. They're like, oh, well, it smells like it's just like, well, it's a human being. It's not like a toy or anything like that. And it was just so amazing to me. And I'm like, they're really desensitized on sexuality. Like, I remember growing up, like, in my act, and you're about to snap a girl's bra off or whatever, and your adrenaline was just like, oh my God, wow, I see breasts. And now it's just like nothing. You know what I'm saying? Like, I couldn't imagine a kid getting excited or a person getting excited now, because it's all over and it's everywhere. So right. It's like the mindfulness now, going back to mindfulness for us in this society, this first world society, is going to be like so important that it's going to be like, if you're not mindful, I don't really know how humanity is going to move forward. And it might going to be like life or death, because it's like you said, birth rates are down. Like, I have never, you know, had my parents in their 40s, in their 40s, have friends that didn't have kids. Now, I know a lot of people don't, but that's fine. But I feel like nowadays it's like astronomical.
Yeah. As you say, it's a choice now.
Right.
It's a choice. And indeed, if you wind the clock even further back, it was a necessity at one point, right? Having kids was survival, right? You had to have kids so that they could work to take care of you. Yep. If you were lucky enough to get old.
Yep.
Right.
Yeah.
Then your kids, then at that point, they're growing the food to keep you alive. So shit's just changed so profoundly, so rapidly. You know?
Yeah. Cause people tell me like, oh, you have four. Oh my God. I'm like, man, my grandmother, my mom had five total. My grandmother had 10. My other grandmother had 5. So it was like, you know what I'm saying? I was like, I mean, that's kind of, but then there were times where people had 15, like, just putting them out, like you said, like that was kind of like the norm. Nowadays, it's like, it's people be like, oh, I'm 40. I've never been married, don't have any kids, and I'm single. And I tend to think about that, like, man, can you imagine somebody saying that in the 60s? Somebody will be like, you must be insane. Is something wrong with you? You know what I mean? Like, that's nothing to brag about.
Yeah.
I mean, like, and this is not to get on people that can't physically have kids, because I know there's sometimes trouble. But then it's like, if it's done intentionally and you were to go back in those days, you'll be labeled as like, really, like, something is wrong with this person.
Yeah.
But now it's like, oh, yeah, that's okay. Yeah, we're kid free. I'm like, damn.
Yeah. Times have changed, man.
Yeah.
And the mindset with it, the cultural norms, and this is how rapidly a culture can shift. We're watching a disturbing show at the moment called The Handmaid's Tale.
Oh, yeah.
About, you heard of this?
I tried to watch a few episodes. I can't watch this, man.
It's so dark, man.
Yeah, it was so dark. Too much for me. Yeah. I'm not really.
I know.
I think I did like 2 episodes. And I was like, I'm not about to watch this. I'm okay.
Yeah, it's a lot. It's a lot, right? But the setting being that dystopian future in which the birth rates have really plummeted, right? For the benefit of anyone who's listening who hasn't seen it. And they're going to some really extreme measures there to solve that problem.
Yeah.
It's like, maybe we need to think about some of that before it gets too late, right? Before we have to have fascists taking over the country, taking matters into their own hands, right? Thinking they're doing the right thing.
Yeah. I mean, you hear what's going on in the States. There, some states have outlawed abortions, and then we're bringing in people from across the border. And I'm just like, well, any society, in order to be fruitful, needs citizens, needs people to come work and pay taxes. And our people aren't producing. So it's like, what are they like? I'm looking at it from like a bird's eye view. They're like, all these immigration. But then it's like, I mean, a lot of people are getting abortions. People aren't having kids. So it's like, what do you like? This is kind of like a smart move on our country's end. And I'm sure you're in the UK, right?
Yeah, that's right.
I'm sure you guys have a ton of immigration right now.
We do. Yeah. And the Conservative government here are trying to stop a lot of it. As far as I'm aware, I really don't keep up with politics. But my wife's an immigrant. She came here from India. Mm-hmm. And that was a process, man. We really had to work hard to get her visa and get her settled. Paid a lot of money for the privilege. She now works for the NHS, our health service, taking care of people who are mentally unwell. So we need her.
Right.
We need her.
Right.
But the plot thickens. She chose the UK because she found a job shortage list that was published by the government. And on that job shortage list was psychologist. Mm-hmm. She was like, great, I'll go get a job in the UK. I hear great things about the NHS. When it came to actually getting a job, she couldn't find one for a long, long time. Now, COVID was, of course, a spanner in the works there. But nonetheless, she felt like the rug had been pulled out from underneath.
Mm-hmm.
Because she came here thinking, oh, it's going to be super easy to find a job. They've got no psychologists.
Right.
And then it was a long time before we could get her into where she had to start in an entry-level position. She's got 2 master's degrees and a bachelor's.
Mm-hmm.
And she was there in an entry-level, a junior position, having to work her way up as if she'd never been to university at all.
Damn.
So that was an interesting little chapter in our story.
Yeah.
We're pleased that we got her here in the end. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, so did she come here as an adult?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So it's difficult out here too. I know some friends that were trying to get a visa and stuff like that, but I mean, it can happen. You can't make it super easy, but I'm glad that it happened for you guys.
Yeah. Yeah. Seriously. Yeah. We learned about that whole thing of like, where do they draw the line? Right. Mm-hmm. Like you say, you can't, if you make it too easy,
mm-hmm.
then it's going to be chaos.
Right.
So for us, it was a gamble. I couldn't have seen this coming. We spoke with the solicitor and she said, you need to pay X thousand pounds for the application, X thousand pounds for her health surcharge. You pay a fee so that her health is taken care of if anything happens to her. Then you submit the application and then you'll hear back as to whether your application is successful, right? Oh, and we had to get married first.
Mm-hmm.
We had to get married to even make the application. So I said to this solicitor, hold on, let me check I got this right. I pay you £6,000. I marry my wife. And then we can end up living on separate continents. She said, yep. I said, you got to be kidding me.
£6,000? That's about $6,000, right? I think it's about
now. There's not much between them. I think it would be a few more dollars, maybe $6,500, $7,000.
Yeah. It's pretty much the same now, but God, dog.
Yeah.
For an application? Woo.
Yeah. That's just to ask for the privilege of being allowed into the country, and that can be denied. Yeah. Yeah.
I don't even know how, because I know you guys have a royal family, so I'm not even sure how that will work. I know it's a little different as far as like your laws, but golly, that's crazy.
Yeah. It was a shocker for us, for sure. It's a gamble, right?
Yeah.
It's a gamble because it's all going to come down to how does that person feel on the day that they see your application? How do they feel about the photos you've sent in? They're trying to decide, is it a genuine relationship, right? Or are we being scammed here?
Right.
So we're like, well, we're just going to tell them who we are and how we operate and hope that they see that we're genuine. It's a gamble.
Right. Yeah.
Could have been a very expensive gamble. Luckily, it paid off. and now she's here doing this amazing work as a psychologist within the NHS.
Yeah.
Which was her plan all along. She was like, I'm the real deal. I want to come help you guys.
Man, that's crazy. Well, I wouldn't even think it should be that hard because of the relationship the UK and India had.
Right.
I remember going to Paris and I was like, oh my God, it's a lot of black people out here. Like it was crazy. But then they were like, because of colonization, they were able to go out there to France. But I was like, oh Lord, but yeah, and then I heard there's a big complaint of Europe being majority. I'm not sure if y'all call them minorities or whatever, but basically lot of non-Europeans are going to be the majority in Europe within the next couple decades.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah, that's what I heard. But hold on. No, I think it was Muslims. There's going to be majority Muslim in Europe.
Okay.
Yeah.
Interesting. We're moving toward a global culture.
Right. That's the way I look at it. Yeah.
That's what we're looking at. That's why Brexit seems so fucking crazy to most of us here. We were like, huh? We're moving forward in time, not backwards.
Right.
How does this make sense? Really all a big misunderstanding.
Yeah. I mean, they're trying to retain some type of individual power. I could see that. But now that BRICS is coming about, I'm like, ooh-wee. Like, yeah. It's going to be quite intense.
Yeah. Quite intense. I think they've already lost a lot of money. It's been a very long drawn out process. Again, I don't really keep up with politics, but it just seems crazy to me on a very surface level.
Right.
We're moving towards a global culture, whether we like it or not.
Right.
Surely we're better off in cooperation than isolating ourselves. Like you say, that there is an appeal certainly to maintaining individual power, but Europe wasn't ever trying to govern the UK. Right? We still had the pound sterling. We didn't adopt the euro. So it seemed to me we still had a degree of independence, but I guess it wasn't enough for some.
Right. Yeah. I can see that, man. But I'm, you know, yeah. Because I mean, even with crypto, that's more so like globalization as far as the fiat currency and stuff like that. Then I went to the store the other day and I saw some Korean pop stars on a cereal box. And I was like, wow, this is very interesting. Like, hey, I was just like, what? Who are these people? But then I'm like, I don't have to know them. But if other people are fans, then hey, it is what it is. But I feel like you could really find your tribe now more than ever.
Yeah.
Because somebody was like, what kind of rappers do you listen to? Like, who's your favorite artist now? And some of my favorite artists are like not popular at all whatsoever. Like they will not sell out a show, but they are my favorite artists.
Right.
And I feel like that's like the most powerful thing, going back to what you said earlier in the conversation, is that you could really make money off of your talents now more than ever.
Yeah.
Like I don't have to beg a radio station for an opportunity for my voice to be heard. I can just start a podcast. I don't have to go to a comedy club and hopefully they'll let me on stage. I can just talk in front of my phone and do a reel.
Yeah.
And blow up like crazy. Now they want me and now they're going to pay me X amount of dollars because I'm so famous online.
Mm-hmm.
I was just like, wow. Like if you could really hone into whatever you want to do in your talent and you're not going to give up, you could really make something of yourself now.
It's a beautiful thing. There's no way I would be able to run a business around mindfulness in my city. No way. Just wouldn't find enough people who were interested. Certainly not in the way that I teach it, which is very plain language, no cultural baggage, no real, like, there's no club to join, right? It's just, we're talking about being human and being happy.
Right.
It's very simple. So there's not really a lot to kind of draw people in with. There's a few Buddhist centers here in my city and things, and that's something that people can grab onto.
Mm-hmm.
The major challenge for me coming out online was, how do I make this tangible for people?
Right.
I'm really just talking about what it is to be human, what it is to just be fundamentally okay, right? Mm-hmm. How do I package that up
right.
for people? How right. do I give people a sense of what that is exactly?
Right.
And that was a long, long learning curve. Figuring out. Now, I heard what we were talking about there called the long tail phenomenon the other day. Someone referred to it as the long tail phenomenon, where essentially you can be hyper specific in what you like or what you represent. Meaning, essentially, I'm not sure if you're familiar with the term, brother, but a long term is like a search term.
Mm-hmm.
A long tail search term would be like a search term that you type into Google that is just longer, right? So instead of typing in rap, we're typing in some super specific subgenre of rap, or we're just typing in the artist and going straight to the source, right?
Yeah.
Who goes to Google and types in rap music? Right?
Right.
Probably no one.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So that kind of homogenization is gone. This guy was saying, like, back along, Michael Jackson sold how many million copies of Thriller?
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't happen anymore.
Right.
He said no one is selling that many records anywhere now because the audience is more split.
Right. Oh, yeah. Right? Now more than ever. Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's like, because now I feel like people are, because back in those days, they'll be like, what? You're not a fan of Michael Jackson?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like now it's like, no, I like this now. Or I like, it's just crazy because you could really find your vibe. Because somebody was like, who's your favorite lyricist? And I said the rapper that I like, but then I also had to explain why. And it was like, because I like the subject matter of what they're talking about.
Mm.
You know, like now, but just because I'm a rap fan, that doesn't mean I have to be a Snoop Dogg fan or a Biggie Smalls fan or a Tupac fan. It's like, right. I don't really like it's just crazy, man, how different it is.
Yeah.
Because back when we were growing up, the only thing that we had available was whatever they wanted to bring to us. You know what I'm saying? It's like, if you like rock, you should like these people. But then it's like your mind will end up liking it because it's all that's available.
Yeah.
It's pretty crazy because I go on Spotify and I'm just listening to like a playlist or whatever. And then I'm like, man, I really like this artist. And then I'll go to that artist page and they have like 60,000 listeners a month.
Yeah.
But then I'm like, but I really enjoy their music. I like what they're talking about. And like, it is just so surreal to me, man, where it's kind of like, damn, it's crazy not liking the most popular artists. But just because of how we grew up.
Yeah. It was very.
There you go.
So I grew up with four television channels here in the UK, right? Cable was unheard of. Satellite was super rare. I think you folks over in the States had a bit more selection going on. That was always kind of our dream growing up, right? We heard about satellite TV or cable TV and we were like, wow, like imagine having that much choice. With music, it was pretty much what my parents listened to until I was a teenager. And then I remember there was this tiny kind of backstreet record shop where we could get some niche stuff. And then my tastes were kind of beginning to open up, but it was still limited by what was there in this little, I mean, it was a market store no bigger than this room, which is like, I don't know, they might've had a few hundred CDs there for us to choose from. Right. So that was before then, of course, Napster came along and then it slowly just opened and opened and opened. Mm-hmm. Right. But also we were talking about how the technology enables this long tail phenomenon, right? We can all do whatever the hell we please. The production value on those records for that artist who has 60,000 listeners a month, it's probably just as good as the top artists who are selling. It's like diminishing returns, right? Maybe there's a 5% increase in audio quality. Mm-hmm. Most people aren't going to notice that anyway.
Right.
So there's not that barrier either, right? When Michael Jackson recorded Thriller, it was like, if you wanted to record a record of that standard, you needed access to millions of dollars.
Yeah.
Now you need a laptop.
Yeah. Nah, yeah, seriously. And a hell of a studio. People are making music in their closets. It's like, it's crazy. I've seen people make songs that's like open space and mix it and then boom. So it's like, now it's more so you stopping yourself. Like, we have a different battle where we're battling distractions, we're battling self-doubt, we're battling just being productive. You know what I'm saying? Like, I feel like if some people from those times had the capabilities that we've had, they would go crazy. And I'll tell my daughter, I'm like, man, if I had the internet where you were growing up, I would have been a genius. Like, I used to walk to the library and read books. And like, I was always into researching and learning information. And I still am to this day. And I'm just like, can you imagine just growing up with the cell phone? But then also I have to think like, oh, but there was also porn. There's also this. There's also TikTok. There's also entertainment. But it's like, if you were to really hone in on the positives of us harnessing the technology and ignore the distractions, I mean, you can make monumental shifts.
Yeah. That's seriously basically what I'm out here for, brother. That's what I'm trying to encourage people towards, right?
Yeah.
Let's be deliberate with what we're doing, right? Let's curate that feed. Let's just begin with, hey, what's my great contribution to humanity? What do I want to give? Like, what do I want to remember on my deathbed? What do I want on my tombstone, right? This is drawing from the great Stephen Covey here. You come across that book, Seven Habits of Highly Effective People.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yep, I have that right there. I actually have that.
Man. Book. It's a relic, right?
Mm-hmm.
Begin with the end in mind, right? That whole visualization that he takes us through, right? Think of your funeral. Imagine you're there in the back seat. What do you want people saying about you after you're gone, right? This is the shit that everyone has to face at some point. The question is, are we going to face it ahead of time so that when we're approaching that final hour, we feel good about how we've conducted ourselves, or are we going to keep distracting ourselves, right? Mm-hmm. And the distractions come in so many forms, right? You can waste all of your time on cheap pleasures, but you can also build the wrong empire, right? You can do a lot that would look like success, but that is misaligned with who you really are, what you believe, what you want to represent. A lot of people fall into that trap. So it's like, it's a narrow path, man.
That's a bar. It's a,
yeah. It's a narrow path.
Yeah.
To get to that deathbed and feel satisfied with what you've done with your years.
That's true, man. Cause like, I often think about that, cause I've been to several funerals within these past few years. And my whole question is just like, man, what do I want my obituary to say? And I've never read an obituary that was like, man, he had nice cars, he had rings, he wore nice clothes. It's never about that. It's more so about the legacy that you leave and how you impacted people and your lineage, you know what I'm saying? And I was just like, man, I can't go out like, oh, Sherman was cool. Here's some pictures. All right, cool. Have a nice day. You know what I'm saying? Go about your life. I'm like, nah, I have to be way more impactful. Like you said, because it's like I could put myself in a position to make money. That wouldn't be hard. But then I've always had a high morale and thought to myself, like, what am I doing to make the money? Like, that's one of the most important things to me, rather than, oh, man, I got it.
Yeah.
You know, because it's like because you can make money and be extremely successful putting people in worse positions.
Mm-hmm. Lots of folks got rich off others' misery.
Yeah. And I was just like, nah, I can't do that. I can't get rich off of me doing something where I'm like taking advantage of somebody. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. Taking advantage of somebody that doesn't know any better. I don't want to get rich that way.
Right. And the great thing about where we're at now, again, we're talking about the technology again. We only need win-win arrangements now.
Mm-hmm.
No one needs to be scamming anyone right now, because the technology makes the profit margins so large on what we're doing, right? Like what we're doing here, right? People can profit off a podcast. I hope you make money off your podcast, brother. Whatever our business model is online, the tech takes so much of the cost out of what previously would have been premises and physical product and staff and all of that. Just to do what the tech is doing for us.
Right.
So, of course, that means we can pass that saving on to the consumer. A podcast model, right? More about it than I do. I don't run a podcast. But as I understand it, most people are going to listen for free.
Right.
They're getting the value for free, right? But the host is able to earn based on the number of people that they're reaching, based on other business that will come through that exposure that's earned through the podcast. Is that correct?
Yeah, definitely. But then you have to keep going. It's a process. It's a journey.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think I'm at 70 something episodes. I probably got like 80 plus total though. And some that I have to edit, but I'm like, man, I put a lot of effort into this. Maybe one day, but no, it's just keep going. Cause it's not like I'm like overexerting myself to make it happen. Like I'm not renting out a space. I'm not flying people out. I'm not hiring an expensive engineer. Like a lot of those costs aren't there for me, as they probably would have been, you know, 10, 15 years ago.
Yeah. You'd have had to have analog hardware, right?
Yeah.
Just something's going wrong with it all the time. And now again, right, you need a laptop. That's it.
Right.
So it's all become much more simple, much more compact, much more lean. Meaning again, those profit margins are larger, so we can pass on tremendous amounts of value to consumers for free.
Right.
And then for me in my business, it's then the 0.01% of people who want to go deeper who actually pay me. Right. I got enamored with this business model years back, saw people who were the real pioneers out here in the digital space and thought, this is it. This is, I got to do this. Like I'm out here teaching kids to play drums, which was not a bad job by any means, but it was always a time for money arrangement. There was always a cap on how much I was going to earn. Then the real cap hit me, which was, I'm not really doing a lot of benefit here. Like music is a wonderful thing, but mm-hmm. for most people, it's a hobby. Certainly right. for the people who are coming to me for lessons, it's something to do in the evening, something to do on the weekend. I taught over 1,000 people how to play drums. Very few of them ever set foot on a stage.
Mm-hmm.
For most people, it's a hobby, right?
Right.
Great. Enriching, nourishing, wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
But then after my mother attempted suicide and I got around to really helping someone, I was like, oh shit, I've got a higher calling now. There's more benefit for me to be giving in each of these moments. And so I got to make a change. And that was kind of an uncomfortable realization. No? Mm-hmm. I had this ambition to be a musician since I was a teenager. I was very comfortable in that life. Had a great teaching practice there. And then slowly beginning to see, oh, there's more for me to do.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to need a completely different way of doing business in order to make it happen. Lots of learning curves, right? And exactly as you say, right? With 80 episodes down on a podcast, right? And of course, one of the characteristics of these digital business models is it is a lot of upfront investment of time and energy.
Yeah.
Right. So the transition for me was there during the last year of my music career. I was also beginning to build up this digital career. Mm-hmm. And that was up at 4 a.m, writing for 3 hours, talking to people, making plans. Then I go out the door and I go and teach music for the day, come back a little bit more on the digital business in the evening.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And then, of course, we get into, well, that's why it's so important for us to have that Stephen Covey mindset, that begin with the end in mind. If
right.
we're not doing the thing that we really believe in, we're not going to have the energy or the inspiration to start one of these businesses.
Right.
It's not going to happen, right? If someone's thinking to themselves, oh, I kind of like what these other people are doing online, huh? What shall I start my business about? Oh, there seems to be profit in web design. Let's create a personal brand around. It's never going to work. There's not going to be enough fire to get it done.
Yeah.
Right. Maybe that person gets as far as creating a portfolio. They make a couple of websites and they get bored and they move on to something else.
Mm-hmm.
So it has to be that thing that is deeply, deeply aligned. This is what we teach people with that business coach of mine that you mentioned, Dan Coe, who's doing great, great work educating digital creators in how to represent themselves, how to find that thing that they really care about, that change that they want to see in the world,
mm-hmm.
which that's a big step, just identifying that in the first place, right? And then starting to make moves to actually create a business around it, create a livelihood around it. This is possible for everyone in 2024.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Because I came across a lot of people, even myself, doing like business development and consulting, where it's like people want to start a business, but I'm just like, why do you want to start that business? Like, I know who you are. Like, I don't feel like this is for you. Even if you heard somebody making money doing it, that doesn't necessarily mean that you will. Like, they're passionate about it. And I said in this other podcast, I was like, you can hear that somebody's making money doing, I say, door-to-door sales. But you have to realize that that person is probably knocking on doors 7 hours out the day. Are you willing to do that? Are you willing to go inside somebody's house and see that it looks terrible and it stinks and still have a smile on your face?
You got to either really want money or really believe in the product.
Yeah, right. Right. Exactly. Like, but there's some people that have that persona where they like, they absolutely love that. Oh, and I met a couple of people like, I love knocking on doors. I love meeting people, talking to people. This is that. And I'm like, well, I don't. So hey, it is what it is. Like, that's not my thing. And I tried it and I was absolutely terrified because I'm like, I respect people's space. I don't really like popping up at people's house. You know what I'm saying? And it was just like such a barrier of resistance. And the only reason I was doing it is because I've heard people make money and I know people that make a lot of money doing it. But then I had to realize that, like, man, even though that's the case, this is not for you.
Yeah. So we come full circle to temperament, right? You were talking about temperament with your kids, right? Yeah. Some people, those extroverts, they're not even thinking about invading someone's space. They're like, knock, knock, knock on the door. Hey, how you doing?
How's your day going?
They're drawing energy from that situation, maybe not even thinking about the other person's concerns, right? Yeah. Me, I would be too much in, like, someone actually knocked on my door the other day and I was really deep into writing my newsletter and I was like, who's this at the door, right? Someone canvassing, just, I don't know what they were asking for money for. I said, I haven't got time. And he fair play to him, he really tried. He did pretty well. He kept me at the door for 30 seconds. I said, dude, I don't have the time. I said, you did well, though.
Right.
Keep it up, right? Because, yeah, of course, his job is he wants to keep people engaged in the conversation. He really was doing quite a good job. I couldn't do it, like you. It wouldn't be for me. It wouldn't be for me. I'd be too concerned about the other person's stuff.
Right. Same here.
This guy said he was busy. Yeah. What was he into? What did I interrupt?
Right. And like for me, I'll be like, I cut those people short. And I used to be like, man, you don't want to treat anybody like that. But now I'm thinking about it like, look, man, I don't want you to waste your time with me because I'm not interested at all whatsoever. And I'm not going to smile in your face just to have a conversation. Go try someone else as soon as you can, because nothing is happening here. And once I thought about it from that perspective, it's a lot easier for me to say no.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Yeah. It's like, that's the best reason for you to say no is to like disrespect other people's time.
The compassionate no.
Yeah. Like, you know what? This isn't for me. I'm sorry. Instead of just like sitting there smiling, like, okay, when is it going to be done? Now I'm like, no, it's not happening. Call someone else.
Meanwhile, everyone involved is getting older.
Right.
We're all like stepping toward that funeral, that Stephen Covey funeral, right?
Right.
It's happened.
Right.
These are the moments of our lives, right?
Right.
It sounds almost a little bit obsessive to be thinking in those terms all the time, but once you have a vision, every moment really does become valuable, right? And there have been times in my life when I've not had a vision and the time has not been valuable. And I would have been willing to stand on the doorstep and smile in that person's face and just be kind of passively, life is coming at me, right? I'm reactive. I'm not proactive.
Right.
Man, you got four kids, right? You don't need to be standing on the doorstep entertaining, right?
Right. Right.
Yeah.
Right.
It's too much to be doing. Too much to be doing. And to any of our listeners who don't have that vision yet, there are ways to find it. There are exercises that you can do to figure out what that vision is. So you don't need to be wasting your time. Your time is valuable, even if you don't know what you should be doing with it just yet. There is some great contribution that you can make to humanity. And that is how we're going to end up on that deathbed feeling satisfied. And what a gift to ourselves. What a gift.
What a gift. Seriously. Because, man, that will feel amazing. Like, man, I contributed to society. I watched a TikTok video today. And the guy was just pointing out random things around him. Like, somebody got rich off this pen. That was a dream at first. Somebody got rich off of this paper. That was somebody's dream. Like, all of these things around us, like a microphone, was in somebody's mind before and was a dream. And then they brought it into existence and became successful.
Yeah.
And I was just like, damn, like, being a creator is so powerful. And I feel like we don't really look at that. Like, I guess because we grew up in like the industrial age where it's like being a creator wasn't really like something to be, you know what I'm saying? It was more so being a controller, being like someone that would control and manipulate assets. But I feel like, man, where are the innovators at? Like, where are the people that could take something from their mind and create something that's substantial? And the best example we have today is Elon Musk, like by far. Right. Like when it comes to like a modern person that took something from their mind and created things like the space shuttle and Tesla and all that. But it's just like, man, imagine if we just had more of that.
Well, I think we're seeing the beginning of a renaissance.
Mm-hmm.
I think we're seeing the beginning of where the amount of people who pour into the programs that I work inside with this mentor of mine, Dan Coe, is significant, and more people all the time are getting switched on to this idea. Oh, I can just come out online and start talking about my interests. And that actually can be at least a modest living for me. But actually the truth is there's no cap on what you can earn out here.
Right.
And it just scales and scales and scales as you continue to put the work in. If you listen to what people actually need and give them that, right? So it's not a selfish endeavor, right? It needs to be that win-win arrangement. For me, the first offer that I made online was I started to notice tiny following on Twitter. I was at about 3,000 followers April last year. But I started to notice a pattern. It seemed like a lot of intermediate meditators were coming my way. I was attracting a lot of those folks. And so I even went ahead and polled my audience. I said, how much experience do you have with meditation? And it was a bell curve. So most people were about 1 to 2 years of experience with meditation. I started talking to some of them about what their problems are, what their challenges are with meditation, where they're getting tripped up. And I found out I could make an offer around one of my favorite subjects, which is how to dissolve the boundary between meditation and non-meditation and make your whole life a mindfulness practice. So that's what I made a course around. Got 12 signups in for 4 weeks, transformed them all, got the video testimonials back, and that led to more coaching clients than I've been able to handle. This is how it happens.
Wow, so you did a survey and built. Oh, that's smart. Yeah. That's extremely smart.
These are the kind of systems that we look at. This is all credit to Dan for coming up with these systems. He's a clever dude. He's been studying business for a long time. Mm-hmm. He's made a lot of offers himself and seen how the market moves, right?
Right.
If we can get signal from our audiences as to what they want, that's literally money.
Right. Right. Right.
Mm-hmm. If we price it right, if we make the offer correctly, demonstrate to them. This was difficult for me. Coming from, I had a major dilemma with my primary teacher. That first mindfulness teacher of mine was a monk, right? Lived as a monk. So he was like, you can never involve money in this. And I was like, well, I'm teaching other stuff too. It's not, I've not got the robe on. I'm talking about Stephen Covey, right? How do I? He's like, no money. You can't involve money in this. I'm like, sounds a bit like ownership, dude. Well, I had to come to terms with, he lived as a monk for 8 years. That's just his world. So I was like, well, I'm going to do my own thing over here, right? And so once I kind of reshuffled those beliefs around money in myself, then I was able to say, hey, this is just an exchange of value.
Right.
And indeed, anyone can do this. If you have knowledge in your head, listeners, that knowledge is worth something to someone. This is the number one mental barrier that we see people come through these programs with, is our own knowledge feels so ordinary to us that we can't conceive of how it could be worth money to someone else.
Right.
Right. But if you happen to be someone who loves houseplants, I'm looking at my wife's houseplants right now. She loves houseplants. She's always down on the kitchen floor. We don't have a garden, so she's down on the kitchen floor, right? She's repotting them. There's soil all over the kitchen floor. She makes it happen.
Yeah.
She could easily start an Instagram account around how to keep houseplants.
Yeah.
And that is of value to people. Yeah. And then as that...
My houseplants always die, so I'll definitely.
Oh yeah, okay.
Yeah,
you could be Debbie's first customer.
Yeah, I know it's a technique to it that I just haven't learned.
There you go. Right. Yeah. So there's this great democratization of, if you know something that I don't, and I care about it enough that I'm willing to get my credit card out, you got a business.
Right.
Right. And of course, it's like we need to think about how we price these things, right?
Mm-hmm.
Learning about houseplants probably isn't going to be worth so much to someone as personal development or business coaching or something like that, but it's worth something.
Yeah.
And so we figure out the distribution, we figure out how to reach enough people, and there's always ways to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a business. But this is so different to how everything has been. Like you say, we grew up on the tail end of an industrial revolution, very old school, very solid ideas of how work and business functions.
Yeah.
This is so radically different.
Right. Yeah, for sure.
Right.
For sure.
It's so nebulous, so individual. No one's ready for it, but it's working. Right. And from the outside looking in, I was always like, this is too good to be true. Right. All these people are saying they're making money online. They just come out, talk about their interests. No way. Surely not. They're all scammers. Well, then I watched this mentor of mine, Dan Coe, over time, And I just saw that he was consistent enough with his ideas. Like, this is a genuine dude. This is a genuine dude. No one who's a scam artist is going to be that consistent. Or if they are, they're like the best scam artist of all time. Mm-hmm. Right? Mm-hmm. You'd have to have some serious fucking chops to be fooling people at that level. And so I signed up for his program. And yeah, he's just a dude teaching people how to do a thing. Mm-hmm. That's what it is. Right.
Yeah.
It's that simple.
Yeah, but I mean, he needs money in order to keep going on, you know? But mm-hmm. I kind of understand where the monk was coming from when he said, you know, don't involve money in it, but it just depends on your intention. Like, mm-hmm. you can't use that knowledge to take advantage of people or anything like that, which can happen, which we see people doing with religion and belief all the time by selling hope and things like that. But it's like, if you're creating a system where you're giving energy to them, and you just deserve something back. You know what I mean? Like, that's the only way you're going to survive. But it's not like, I don't know. The way I think about it is just kind of, it's different. I feel like if your intention is wrong, then that's a different case than like you just doing it when it's like, okay, I'm doing this, I'm going to serve people. But in order for me to serve people effectively, I need money. We live in a capitalist society. So it's like, that's what it has to be. Or else you're not going to be able to serve people. So you have to get a job somewhere, or you could serve people in a positive way and make money doing it.
Yeah, that's exactly what I saw, brother. I was in that transition period between the music career and this new career. I would be teaching the same drum lesson for the 12th time to that student who doesn't practice. If anyone in the audience knows a music teacher, they'll know most of their students don't practice. So I'm there going through the motions. Meanwhile, my phone's buzzing in my pocket and I know it's a mindfulness student, and I catch up with them later and they've been having some crisis with their partner, or they had some deep insight in meditation that they really needed to debrief on, or they took too many mushrooms, or they're having a panic attack, or any number of these like really like important deep issues, and I can't answer the phone because I'm doing this other thing for money.
Yeah.
It just became clear as day to me, like, no, I need to start a business around this. There's just more benefit in this direction.
Yeah, because you feel, I also know that you felt like you're just bringing more value to people with the mindfulness, because if you're teaching somebody something and they're not practicing and they're not applying it, you're wasting your time, even if you're still getting paid.
Yeah.
You know, say with me, like, even though I like to get paid, if I talk to you and you're not really doing the work or anything like that, it's like, what? Like, I'm still wasting my time. Like, if you're dealing with somebody, like, say when it comes to fitness and I'm giving somebody a plan and I'm like, are you working plan? Are you doing? And it's like, oh, well, I'm like, oh God. Like, I can't stand. It's like, I'm working for nothing. Like, for money, but also to get you results.
Yeah.
And if you're not putting forth the effort, then the money is just like worthless, because I'm sure if you were like, man, I work with Tommy Lee Jones or something, like a drummer that was really, you know what I'm saying, like torn and stuff like that, man, that would be so fulfilling for you. Yeah, so I get
we want to see those results, and those results fuel our business on the other side as well. We want those killer testimonials from students who really did the work, right?
Yeah, did I say Tommy Lee Jones? What's the name of the drummer from
I think it is. Yeah, there's a famous drummer named Tommy Lee Jones,
Okay.
Yeah, I can't remember what band he was from. Or is it, no, wait, is Tommy Lee Jones the actor?
Yeah, Tommy Lee Jones is the drummer. Actor. Yeah, okay, Tommy Lee. Drummer. Yeah, my bad. Yeah, but he was a part of, they just had a movie about it called
Motley Crue.
Yeah, Motley Crue, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah. I wish I knew the drummer off of the Tom Sawyer song by Rush.
Neil Peart.
Oh man, that guy was killing on that song. I remember when I first heard it, I was like, oh my God.
Something like
that
right.
was intense.
Yeah.
Still haven't heard anything that could beat that. Oh, speaking of drumming, have you seen the movie
Whiplash?
Yeah, Whiplash, exactly.
Yeah, I saw Whiplash. Yes, yeah. It took me a while to see it, actually. And I was still very much in my music career at that time. So everyone I bumped into was like, have you seen Whiplash? Have you seen Whiplash? And I'd have to say, no, I haven't seen it yet. Mm-hmm. Finally sat down and watched it with my father. Interesting movie.
Yeah. It's one of my favorites when it comes to like drive, perseverance, dedication. Mm-hmm. I was like, this movie is crazy because it's like, it hits you in so many ways that you do not expect.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying? And it's like that guy did like a cold manipulation to get people to be great.
Yeah.
Even if it was like, it was unethical by our standards, but then it's like, it still brought results when it came to greatness. And very, very interesting though. I was like, whoa, these guys are acting in this movie.
They really did. The price of greatness is something that fascinates me endlessly, brother.
Mm-hmm.
I must have watched the Bulls documentary, The Last Dance, 3 or 4 times over now.
Oh, wow.
Just looking at all the dynamics in that whole setup and what it cost Jordan to be that great.
Yeah.
Fascinating.
Yeah. Fascinating. I sat my daughter down actually like 2 weeks ago and had her watch that whole thing. Cause she she likes Jordan shoes, but she has no idea who Jordan really is and what he was. Now she's like, oh yeah, I'm a Jordan fan now. And I'm like, sure, but hold on, do you see what he had to do to become Jordan? Like, and I told her, I was like, you're a Kobe fan, but I bet you didn't know Kobe airballed his first shots in the NBA. What? He did? Yeah, he airballed. He didn't make threes like that. He had to work at it. And so it's just amazing, man. Like when the way greatness is projected to us, it's like it must be a gift. Like they just must have been born with these capabilities. It's never that they've been working at these capabilities all fucking day for years and years and years. They want to present it to us like this person is great because of them.
Yeah.
No, but then you start to see like, man, they're regular people just like us. They just worked at it.
Yeah.
Like there's nothing special about like when you look at like The Last Dance, you see Jordan laughing, joking, like the same things we would do, like intense, you know what I'm saying? Like, but then when he got on the court, he has to perform.
Yeah. Yeah. Did you come across that book by his trainer, Tim Grover, Relentless?
Yeah.
Incredible.
Gotta
book,
be
right?
A cleaner. Yeah. I actually seen Tim Grover speak live in March. Like I saw that he was gonna be on the tour. I was like, yeah, I gotta hear him talk.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. That guy's got some energy himself, right?
Yeah, yeah. Like I love watching his interviews too. I just I like how intense he is.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I wish I had a trainer like Tim Grover. I'll be on top of the world.
Right.
Yeah, man. Yeah, this conversation is gonna have me like revisit my intensity, what I need to cut out. Because this is a second conversation that I've had this week when it comes to like cutting out things that don't serve you and like really focusing in on what does serve you and what you need to do and what you're productive at. Because it's amazing hearing like your contrast where it's like, man, I was making money, but it wasn't serving me. And to the average person, it's like, how wasn't it serving you when you were making money?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So it's like, this is a great testimony, man. Really want to thank you for being a part of this and sharing your story and being vulnerable enough to share. It's hard for some people to say to the world that I have a mother that attempted suicide. You know what I mean? Like that takes some real guts because I could say within my family, it's more so like, don't tell anybody, keep it to yourself. But you're like, no, this is something I had to deal with. And I'm sure other people are dealing with it too. So I don't mind sharing it. So I want to give you kudos for that. And so where can people find you?
So I'm at dangoldfield.com. That's got links to all my socials. I run my newsletter there every Saturday. That's the best place to find me, brother. And hey, thank you for having me. I appreciate the appreciation. It's been great to talk with you.
Likewise, man. And have a great rest of your day.
You too, brother. Catch you next time.
Yes, sir.
We hope you're leaving this episode feeling empowered. Remember, greatness is a choice. To stay updated on our latest content and continue sharpening your edge, hit that subscribe button. Let's keep grinding together. Remember to visit militantgrind.com.